Hi, and welcome to Jolly's Fall 2020 podcast series. This is Dan Jin, the Academic Book Review Editor of the Journal of Language and Literacy Education, a peer-reviewed open access journal housed in the Department of Language and Literacy Education at the University of Georgia. Today, I will be speaking with Dr. Dan and Dr. Johnson. Dr. Dan is an assistant professor of English education at the University of South Florida. Dr. Johnson is a program officer for education for the Educational Network of Greater Grand Rapids and is a university supervisor at Florida Gulf Coast University. Their manuscript is titled Lost in English Classroom, a study of English teachers' emotion management during literature instruction. Thank you for joining me today. I look forward to hearing more about your work. My first question is, your manuscript begins with a description of Rose's response to literature teaching after suffering a personal loss. How would you first notice English teachers' emotion and emotion management within that situation? In other words, what inspired your work on English teachers' emotion management?
Thank you so much for that question, and thanks to Jolly for hosting us to talk a little bit more about our paper. We're really excited to be here. And I think the way that I would answer that question is I first noticed teachers' emotion management in the process of interviewing teachers. That became the first round of interpretation and analysis of the data, because when talking with English teachers about their personal loss experiences, there were particular moments in interviews that stood out, or perhaps produce an emotion in me or produce an emotion in the teacher. And often it was around some kind of intimate moment that perhaps the teacher had been hiding from students in the course of the actual event that was happening and was now sharing with me in a moment when they were not in front of students. And so it was something maybe they were talking about that they don't normally talk about, or something that they share about their experience that they typically don't share with their rooms full of students. So with Rose in particular, I remember a lot of moments from her interview, but I specifically remember her talking about The Crucible and what that text meant to her and how it impacted her following her experiences with infant loss. I remember other things besides her words, including the way her eyes looked or the way her face looked down when she started talking about certain experiences. And so how I would notice emotion management is there were kind of lived moments of the interview experience that stuck out to me. And then when Ashley and I went back and looked at the data, we would look more closely at how the teachers would narrate that particular experience and what kind of language were they using to explain that experience. And that's kind of how we began our analysis process.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for spending time and energy on doing research on this topic. That's really wonderful. And the second question is, in your manuscript, you illustrate that the study is situated within a feminist framework. How does this framework inform your perception of emotion and emotion management?
I think it was really important for Mandy and me to build from a feminist framework for emotion, because we wanted to recognize a long history of feminist scholars of emotion and who argue that emotion is not just individual, but also social, that it is impacted by the situations we find ourselves in and our interactions in those situations. And this is particularly important for thinking about emotion management, because over time, as we repeat these interactions, certain emotions seem to become appropriate, often because of power structures of gender, race, class. And in our thinking about emotion management, we're influenced by what has become appropriate. What is the difference between what we feel and what we think people expect us to feel, or even what we ourselves expect to feel? And particularly for teachers who are in a service profession, right? That's what Hochschild offers us, is a way of thinking that we actually consciously do work to match our emotions or our displays of emotion to that which is appropriate.
Thank you. And can you share with listeners how you found participants who match the experience the study investigated, then build a trusted relationship with them?
Yes, that's such a great question. So the way that the participants came to be in this study, I would say that the trust was built first and then the participants were found. So what actually happened is I was working with teachers in my local community for a variety of reasons, some of which were related to my institution and some of which were related to my research. And in my encounters with teachers, I was very upfront with teachers about how I understood what it was like to be an English teacher because I had been one. And I talked a lot about how in my experiences as a teacher, I often felt I had to hide aspects of myself and that that was very draining. And I think because I shared this with teachers, they came to see me as someone who was on their side and who really supported them and with whom they could share honestly about their experiences. So when I started doing this work about grief and loss, I reached out to some teachers who I had worked with in the community and said, I'm interested in talking with teachers about this. You're welcome to volunteer yourself or send this invitation to teachers that you know. And some of the teachers volunteered themselves and others sent messages to teachers they knew and said something like, you know, I know this person. She really cares about teachers. She's really an advocate for teachers. You can trust her with your story. And so I'm really lucky that teachers vouched for me. And that's really how I found the participants who came into the study who were volunteers. I did not want to force anyone to talk about grief and loss. I wanted people to participate who really wanted to share something about their story.
Yes, I also noticed that in your manuscript, you, in order to create a comfortable environment for them to share their stories, you also invite them to your own house to have a conversation. An email, is that right?
Yes, so some of the participants chose to be interviewed in their classroom, I think because it was convenient and because we had discussed in setting up the interview that it would be important to schedule a time where the teacher maybe wasn't going to have to teach a class right afterwards or wasn't going to have to go do something work-related right after, because many of these interviews were very intense, very lengthy, very personal. And then so some participants selected to come to my house instead of being interviewed in their classroom if that was something that they felt would kind of increase their ease with the topic.
And in your manuscript, you mentioned that you created questions that were grounded in the life world. So can you explain a little bit more about how you designed the questions for interviewing the participants?
Absolutely. So questions grounded in the life world. Life world is a phenomenological term, and my interviews were designed from a phenomenological tradition. Life world just means the lived experiences of participants. It's the study of the things themselves. So the best way I can explain this is that in designing questions in an interview, I wasn't looking for participants to abstract from their experience or to explain the whys of their experience. I rather wanted them to tell me what happened in their experience from their perspective. And then I wanted to think about what I thought of that experience later. So for example, I might, you know, if a teacher was telling me something that happened, so like I remember one of my participants who I write about in the article, she talked to me about being afraid of losing it in front of her class. And she said this phrase, losing it, multiple times. And instead of asking a question like, why do you think you were afraid to lose it? Or what roles as a teacher did you feel like propelled you to stay in control? Those would be kind of abstract questions. Instead, I would ask her something like, what would it look like if you were to lose it in front of your classroom? To try to elicit from the participant sort of concrete details about a lived experience that that teacher may or may not have had. And then I would use that experience as the groundwork for the analysis.
Thank you. That's so good. Because when I read your manuscript, I find that you have a lot of thought when you design the questions. Like you want to achieve your goal. And also on the other hand, you have some considerations for their emotion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you code the data, you categorize the data into emotion suppression and emotion work. Can you explain the difference between the two terms? And how does the category help you answer your research questions?
Of course. I think that it was really important for us to look at both emotion suppression and emotion work, because emotion management can look different for different people, right? It's not all the same. And then you see that across our data. But when Hochschild established emotion management, that was the larger, broader concept. And within that, she has emotion suppression and emotion work. Emotion suppression, you can kind of think of it as like, I'm going to push down my feelings so that they don't come out. People can't see them. And so for a teacher in our study, that might be, I am teaching this text. It makes me feel sad. I'm not really doing anything with that sadness except keeping it down so that no one knows that that's how I feel. And then emotion work is actually taking that emotion and shaping it into something that you feel might be more appropriate. And so for a teacher in our study, right, we might feel sadness and grief in the midst of experiencing loss. And you could shape that into hope or optimism about things getting better, because that's a more acceptable emotion to display for a teacher in a classroom. And so that's really the difference between the two. And it helped us think about our research question about how teachers manage emotion, because when we found the excerpts of teachers talking about their emotion management and we're coding, we were looking at those verbs, right? And so when we're looking at Rachel and she's talking about teaching the giver, and she's specifically talking about avoiding, right? Or talking about these issues that bring up sadness for her, she's hiding it, right? She's not bringing it out. But then we're reading Tara's description of her teaching, and she specifically talks about how she shapes her emotion. She psychs herself up. She does self-talk to talk about the house on Mango Street with her students, and she changes the classroom reading experience to be very much about reasoning and analysis of the literature, something we might expect to be a purpose for reading in the class.
Also, I noticed that you present the chart about the emotion management and the emotion suppression. Would that chart help readers to reflect their own emotion?
I think so. I think that's another helpful part of this, is because one thing we really want is for us to be just aware, right, of our emotions. They are present. They are there. And how can we think about what we're doing in the classroom and how we manage our emotions in service of something that is unstated, these rules that we live by in the classroom. And part of maybe teaching differently or being in different kinds of relationships is being aware of the work that we're doing.
And what suggestions would you like to give to English teachers who have to deal with their emotions while you're teaching in the classroom?
Sure, I'll start. I think we'll both talk about this one. This is a hard question, right? But I think the first thing I want to just say is that we all are going to have emotions in the classroom. It might be in response to the literature or in response to something else that happened that day. And so just even recognizing that we have them, I think, is important. And now, especially, there's so much going on in our world, and that we as teachers are human beings who feel. And how can we think about that even as we're acting in service of students? And then as someone who thinks a lot about how we teach reading, I think the stories of our teachers in this study do show the power of reading literature and the emotional responses that it can bring out, even literature that we as English teachers may take for granted, like The Crucible. There is great emotional power in reading these texts for us and for our students. And so I think that just highlights how complex the teaching of literature can be, and to be okay with that in the classroom.
So I'll add on to what Ashley's saying here, say that one of the reasons I wanted to interview teachers about this topic is that I really want teachers to know that they're not alone. I felt very alone as a teacher. I felt very isolated. And in so many ways, the participants in this study healed that for me, because I was able to talk to these teachers about their experiences, and we were able to relate to one another about common and shared experiences in a way that I was not able to do when I was in my own classroom. And so what I hope to give to English teachers who might be reading this article is the knowledge that they aren't the only ones that do emotion work, and that sometimes we don't even recognize the emotion management work and suppression that we do as work. And so when it takes its toll, we feel guilty or ashamed of the toll that it's taking. And so what I want to say in the article is that it's okay to feel those things, and you're not alone. And what I hope is that we can begin talking with one another as teachers about what our work truly requires of us. And I would say that that includes emotion management. And that when we begin talking to one another about these experiences, we can reduce isolation and create support for one another.
Very good suggestions from both of you. The last question I want to ask you is that, how would you like to see your research inform other scholars to understand the English teacher's emotion management?
Well, I think that one of the things that Ashley and I have been thinking about in the work that we've been doing together is that there is work in English language arts scholarship already about emotions and literature, but often this work has focused on students and students' responses as well as students' emotions. And so one of the things that we're hoping our research does is inform scholars about how teachers fit into that equation and what experiences teachers may be bringing to the literary text that they work with in their classrooms, because we believe that a more balanced perspective that accounts for both teachers and students' experiences, especially difficult experiences such as death, trauma, and loss, provides a more balanced viewpoint and a more complex understanding of what reading and writing and being together in English language arts classrooms is really like.
It's really wonderful to hear so much, so many insights from both of you. And thank you, Dr. Dunn, and thank you, Dr. Johnson, so much for speaking with you today.
Thank you.
Thank you.